Hi there, and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Have you ever wondered how a disabled person lives their life? Join our host, Lois Drachen, as she chats to people about work, education, travel, sport, the arts, and leisure, and the tools and techniques they use to live their lives with the disability. And now, on with the show.
Hi there, and welcome to today's episode of A Different Way of Seeing, a podcast where we talk all things disability. I'm your host, Lois Drachen, and I am so excited to introduce you to today's guest, Gofran Alias. Gofran's story spans a number of different countries. She was born in Iraq. She traveled to the USA, lives currently in Canada, and in fact, is joining us currently all the way from Turkey. So we're going to be digging into a little of Gofran's story and the book that she recently released and just a little about the work that she is doing and her thoughts on navigating the education system. Gofran, thank you so much and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing.
Thank you, Lois. I have not been this excited in a very long time, so I'm happy to be here.
It is really great to have you with us. Now, I've had the privilege of reading your book and learning a little bit about at least part of your story. But my listeners haven't yet had that pleasure. So can you tell us just a little bit about who you are and the shape of your general story?
Absolutely. My name is Gofran Alias. As Lois just mentioned, I am a 28-year-old woman originally from Iraq. I immigrated traveled from Iraq to the United States at age 10, 9 and a half, around then, to have what was called a life-saving surgery, as I was a person who lived with an opening on my spine caused by a birth defect called spina bifida, and left me uncertain in this world and where my life is going, or if I had a life. For 10 years prior to having surgery, and then after having three surgeries, I came to Canada, and Canada was where I officially began my education, began to live after managing to stay alive. So that was the journey that I call going from staying alive to living a life that I desire. The life I desire began in Canada. And that's about me.
That's great. Tell us a little bit about what you're currently doing.
I do a lot of things, but so that's a hard question because I'm still finding my way to where I'm meant to be. But I'm currently the founder of a not-for-profit organization called Beyond Abilities International, an organization that was influenced by my journey and the barriers that I faced, the accomplishments that I made, and the things that I was able to do after transitioning from my homeland. But I do support part of a team, not alone, youth and adults with disabilities, to show people that they indeed do have a life and can do things that are offered to those in the mainstream world, but single out disabled people.
Great. Thank you for sharing that with us. And hopefully we'll get a chance to dig into a little bit more about what your NGO offers and how you work with people. But I want to go back to the start of your story. So you were born in Iraq with a birth defect, spina bifida, and you had to work through that. Your parents had to work through that at a time of total crisis in the country that you were living in. Mm-hmm. Just, can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you and your family experienced when you were a young child living in Iraq?
Yeah, so that was a question that I thought deep and hard about. And in the thinking process, it came to me that challenges are more than what meets the eye. So I may look like I'm living life, I'm crushing it, I'm doing all the things that quote unquote typical people do, but there is more behind the scenes of how I got here. So in terms of what my parents faced, we could be here all day. but going down to the simple and what seemed to be simple and basic things like accessing medical supplies. I did not live in a country that, like the one I immigrated to, that has universal healthcare, where medication is covered, where I could go to the doctor without breaking the bank, so to speak. It was, supplies were very limited and led to my mom having to be extremely creative. And I talk about this in my book, sewing pieces of gauze, because they witnessed, but I also witnessed as the young child that I was, blood seeping out of my back because my wound was open and hollow. Challenge. So that I would say would be categorized as the obvious challenge that my parents and I faced. But the less obvious or not obvious at all were the emotional challenges and the challenges that are emotional that my parents faced are far beyond me, and I cannot speak enough to them because I could not even imagine having a child like myself be raising them in my 20s in a country that, like the one my parents and I lived in at the time, where there was war, there was crisis, a lot of the doctors that were on the high end and were knowledgeable had escaped to safer locations to pursue better career opportunities, to find, just to seek refuge and to find a safer place to be in. And then there were the doctors that were left behind that took my mom out of their office every single visit with the news that your child might be stillborn. or will be stillborn. There was not the word might. Your child will be born with facial deformities. Your child will be blind. Your child will be deaf. If your child manages to come into this world, she will only live for 24 hours. And on and on and on. You should consider abortion. Because the quality of your child's life isn't going to be one of quality.
I can't even begin to imagine the impact that being told something like that must have on a mother, on a father expecting a child. And despite all of the information that they had been given, you came into the world, you survived, and you continued surviving and growing. That must have taken a huge amount of work, of effort, of love, of care, of determination from and by your parents. For you as a young child growing up, what were other implications? I know, for example, that you weren't able to receive education at this point. Talk about the impact of what that was like for you.
It was one of deep emotion that I had the opportunity to then express in my book, and only then, having writing and having language as a tool to put into words what I was feeling. It was not until the point of writing the book and bringing it out that I was truly able to sit there and ask myself, how did I feel in those moments? But because I was unaware, I was aware that I was different. I was aware that I was, quote unquote, not typical. That word was not part of my dictionary then, but it is now. Because I am the second oldest child, seeing my sister come home from school. And then another brother was added that went to school. So there were two that were coming home right before my eyes, going to school, and I was not. And that was unexplained by those around me, and I could not explain it within me. But then it later was, and I also became aware of it through being educated and pursuing the studies that I have pursued, that people aren't able to see the world a different way. There's only one way of seeing. You either open up your eyes or you don't. And I had a lot of why questions. And a lot of them included, why me? Why can't I? What would it be like for me to do the very thing that I am seeing? And at times when you see someone do that thing, and a lot of the times they make it look easy. like, so why not? So yeah, it was one of very deep emotion. I can sit here and talk your ears out all day. But yeah.
So when you were still quite young, mm-hmm. you had the opportunity of traveling through to the United States of America mm-hmm. to have, as you say, life-saving surgery. Tell us about how that happened. And then I'll kind of talk a little bit, ask you a little bit about the impacts of what shifted and what changed for you having had that surgery. So how did it come about that you had the opportunity of traveling for the surgery?
So a group of volunteer doctors came to from the States to the town that I was then living in that was impacted by the war. And I, even though I was young, I recall this day like it was yesterday. My dad's uncle comes into my home and meets my mom in our at the door and says that there is this group of doctors that came that are giving advice, volunteering their time and so on. Why don't you go take your daughter to for them to give her something to use for her wound? Those were his exact words. And then my parents, you know, it was like they ran for it. They went. And I remember going with my dad, because my mom had to stay home and take care of the other three siblings that I had. And I remember sitting on the table, and then all these strangers were around me. It was like, and I had a fear of men, and I'll get to talking about that in a minute. But they told my dad in this foreign language that I didn't understand at the time, aka English, that they were going to try to make arrangements for me to come to the States.
Okay. So ultimately, you did travel to the USA and underwent the first surgery there.
Mm-hmm.
What was the impact of having that surgery on the way you were living your life?
That I was living my life or am?
Well, the change that it brought about.
So I'm going to take you back to the day of my surgery. Or to me, it was the day of my surgery. And having read my memoir, I think you know exactly why. I woke up and to me, I looked like I was in the same room that we were waiting in for them to pull me back to the OR to do the surgery and to close the wound, to fuse my spine and all that. And I woke up, I looked around and you know, everything was the same. I had remembered it. And I had a moment of silence before spitting out the words, "Have I had the surgery yet?" And my mom, in between laughter, but also tears. And I'm saying these words with tears in my eyes right now, that said, touch your back. Those were the only two words she can speak. Touch your back. I pulled my hand back. And for the very first time in 10 years, nothing was what I had remembered it. My hand just fell because my back was straight and flat.
What changed in terms of the way you navigated the world, having had that surgery?
So for me, the word navigated or navigating is both physical, but it's also a whole lot of other things. Because as a disabled woman yourself, you might relate to the words that I did overcome physical barriers, but there were also the big word, the big A word, attitudes that I have yet to overcome, and I don't know if I ever will. And I felt a sense of normal. I could not convince myself that this was only a little bit more normal than what I had felt for the past 10 years of my life. But I was able to convince myself that I was fully normal. I was now going to live. And no one's going to come up to my parents' face or mine. Whether that happened or not is a whole other thing. And come up to our faces and say, she's going to die in a day. I was not frightened of seeing blood seeping out of my back on a daily basis. I got my first wheelchair. I was able to move around and experience the world on my own and do the things that I hadn't been able to do for the past 10 years. Everything was normal because it's not the way it was 10 years prior.
Now, this was the point where your family moved to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And at this stage, your father was with you, your mother was with you. I think some of your siblings were with you as well. Am I correct?
My siblings came after, and that was, I believe, an added 8 months on top of the 2 years or 1 year that I had been separated from them. But that was another process filled with emotion for my entire family, including myself.
From reading your book, mm-hmm. I know that this was the point that you were, the first time actually, that you were able to start going to school. Tell us about the impact of that.
So at the point that my siblings followed, and if reading my book, you'll notice that I'm a little date crazy. My date are very significant, and they play a significant role in my memory. But my siblings came on July 27th of 2007. I started school on May 7th, 2007. So experiencing my new self, my new identity, who I was, it was like, I'm going to be able to show my siblings who I am. My new self, and I'm just like you, and now that there's no difference, because I felt for the longest time that this was the one thing that divided us, and that's what made me feel that I was drastically different from them and every other child that was around me, because one of the things that I might not have explained really well, or maybe I have, that I came from a large family that I was always surrounded by siblings, cousins, you name it. So I was like them, and I was like every other child that I had met in my journey.
You did. I mean, one of the things that I picked up quite strongly in your book is how quickly you started almost devouring education, having had the opportunity, and how quickly you really were catching up with the other learners of your age, because starting school at 11 or 10 or 11 is a very difficult experience. Mm-hmm. And you were so fast in catching up and learning the basics and then moving on to the more advanced work. But at the same time as you were having all these successes and the joy of receiving education, being the same as the other children around you and your siblings and cousins, I know that you also did experience some challenges through the education system. Tell us about those challenges. What was the problems that you were experiencing?
Oh, yeah. What I would say is that my education, I was hungry to learn. I was eager. I was ready to knock down barriers, but it wasn't all a rosy picture. I mean, I didn't have that sense of vocabulary then, but this is me speaking now, that if there's a will, there's a way. I was willing to knock down the barriers that I faced. I did face a lot. This might sound strong, too strong of a word, but I was bullied. And what still stands as shocking to me is that this did not more been more often than not came not from my peers, but from the educators that I worked with and from the educational assistants that I worked with that were there to quote unquote support me. But I always struggled with this feeling of, I'm doing you a favor, be grateful for it. And I think as an advocate sitting here in front of you today, that's something that we have to get rid of, because my experience is not mine alone. I do now know a bazillion other disabled people that experience that. And I did not have a response then, but I have a response now. No, you're not doing me a favor. You're doing what you're supposed to do, because this world did not have me in mind. I was not expected. And I know now I'm speaking in metaphors, but getting down to the specifics of what I faced, I faced a lot of attitudes. Because I went to an all disabled school. All those around me were students with disabilities of many kinds. But it was the attitudes. As I'm sitting here talking to you, one of the ones that crossed my mind is a moment where I was told by an educational assistant that I have to, because I needed a two-person transfer at the time, I had to help her transfer myself in the way that a two-person transfer is done, which means lift my legs while she's lifting my upper body. And I recall coming home with a sore back from doing that, because it hadn't been something that I had ever done. And this was at an all-inclusive school where it was, I won't even say predominantly, it was all disabled students. So it was equipped to meet my needs.
Or supposedly so.
Or supposedly so.
In our conversations about this that we've previously had, I very strongly got the sense that as you progressed through your secondary education and I don't know so much in the school for the special school for children with disabilities, but then moving on to the mainstream school and in high school, that you felt very strongly that you lacked agency in the decisions about the schooling process. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So if I may, I want to jump back to the challenges to fill in one more gap, and say that I was even given attitudes for the way I held my notebook. It was like, don't hold your notebook sideways when you're writing, you have to hold it straight up. And I had a vision and still do have a vision problem and wear glasses and I see my book a certain way. But as a grown-up, I was trained that the only right way of seeing is if you hold your book straight. Jumping back to your question about the challenges I faced in high school. So when I first came into high school, ninth grade, I was on cloud nine. Everything was going my way. The educators around me saw my potential. And that's, I think, the biggest, I would say, for me, but I would dare to speak on behalf of other disabled folks and say, we have potential. It's just getting that one, at least one person to see it. And at the first high school that I went to, I had a lot of people that thought. I was taking college classes, going from locally developed or essential. They were called, or they are called in Canada, to applied level or college classes. And I was a straight A student. And every single teacher that I had, when they learned about my background and that English is now my first language, and I had started school at 11, and I didn't always live in Canada. They liked what they saw. And everyone was happy. And this continued for grade 9, grade 10, and grade 11. And at the end of my grade 11 or 10, I found out that grade 11, I was moving. And this was going to be our first purchased home that was accessible for me, and it was modified, and I was going to do everything that I needed to do on my own, being the 17-year-old that I was. So, yay. But then it also meant moving schools. And all you can think of is it was just getting good. And also, like, it's like sitting in a comfy seat and somebody tells you to get up and give up your seat. I gave up my seat, moved, and it was like you've overcome so much. And the one defining word in your life has been change. So just add another to the bucket. So I handled all that. But then that summer, I was reunited with my family, with my dad's family, my grandparents, after I had found out about the move. So it was like, I have a big house. My extended family's coming. They were going to live with us. It can't get any better. And everything else faded. And then my grandfather got sick. And he went from being sick to really sick. And I had gotten the news after spending a couple months with him, introducing this new human. Even though he has always thought that I was good enough, but still excited to see my glow and to see that I was introducing this new human, and telling him about my accomplishments. And I describe myself as a little kid, even at 17 years old, coming home every day, telling him about my grades, telling him that I had this in mind and that and the other, telling him that I had plans to be on the honor roll. And then he passed. He passed after me giving myself a self-talk on a daily basis during his time of struggle that he was going to get better. He was going to get through this. And I think not only being so young, but being so attached that there was no such thing as death. And my grandpa's death was actually the first death I had experienced in my family. So then I moved to a new school. The new school teaching methods were different. It was another Catholic school, but everything was different. One of the things I forgot to mention, or that you might have found out, that I am Muslim, which means I wear what's called a hijab at a certain age. I was treated drastically different for that, and that affected the way I pursued my academics and made teachers, specifically one, feel the need to tell me on a single day, on a daily basis, that I had a disability and now I needed to be diagnosed with a learning disability, that I was not going to go to college, but that's okay. I needed to stay in high school till I was 21. Being asked on a daily basis if my parents have ever reviewed my psych ed assessment with me, and discuss my weaknesses, and the word strengths was not existent. Being pressured to have a perfect attendance, because having the permission to get off school for days that I was physically unable to get out because of my back problems. And I could not even spit the words out that I'm grieving, because no one cared. And I particularly recall a day where my mom finally came to the school, because she has had it, and was like, why is my daughter coming home crying on a daily basis? hasn't she already been through enough? And that she's grieving. And she has just lost her grandfather. And I come home. I mean, I come to school the next day with, I'm sorry. I never knew you were going through that. Are we turning this into a pity party? Do I have to tell you what I'm going through for you to treat me right? And it was a power struggle to prove myself. And I will end here with this challenge because even as far as I have come today, I still recall it. It still brings me to tears and I'm filled with anguish. I'm angry. That I came up to that spec ed teacher, showed her that I had finally gotten a letter of acknowledgement from one of the college programs. And I was like, I got a letter of acknowledgement, which to me means something's happening. They noticed me. And her very words were, it's only a letter of acknowledgement. Don't get your hopes up.
I just want to remind people something you said earlier, that you were a straight A student, that you were working towards the honors list, and yet this was how the attitudes with which people were judging you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really encapsulates so much that it says about the limited expectations that people often have of us as people with disabilities, not to mention the other things that you'd overcome in terms of not being an English first language speaker, starting school at a later age as you did. Despite all that, all they could see was that side of it, but not the results that your work, your determination, and your intelligence was showing. So from there, you did go on to tertiary education. And it was while you were doing some college courses that you met an instructor, a teacher who has become a very influential person in your life, a mentor, and really shifted what you believed was possible for you. Can you tell us about the impact tell us a bit about why his guidance, his mentorship, was so fundamentally important in the way you saw the world?
So I have thought of this question in a way that I have never thought of it before for the past 10 years, because that's how long I have been mentored by. Will, as you come to know him, in my book. At the point that I had come into his class, I was grieving, but I was not only grieving the loss of my grandfather, I was grieving the loss of myself. This person that I once knew, that could do things, was a straight A student was someone that everyone knew was intelligent, that everyone believed in. For me, has died as well. His mentorship and what he was able to do, he wasn't able to bring my grandfather back, and no one ever will. But I found myself again. That I can achieve. No one can stop me from it. That I was good. I was good at this thing called, and back then, the worst nightmare was writing. And I genuinely do call it my worst nightmare because it was through the lens of writing essays that I viewed myself as worthless. But through his mentorship, through the daily things that he was doing, I got the answer, yes, you can. And I think what a lot of teachers are good at is I know stuff, and that's why I'm standing in front of you, and I'm perfect. So you are going to sit in your seat and you're going to listen to me pour these things onto you. And nowhere are the imperfections mentioned. But this one teacher did not hold back from repeating. People, I have 3 degrees, but I still can't do stuff. I still make mistakes. And I think the one thing that academia has done to both disabled and non-disabled students was that as long as you come into the classroom, whatever mistakes you have in your bag, out the door. Or another way I'd like to phrase it is you have a pencil in your hand, but you're not given an eraser because it's not meant to have a use. But he made it a safe space to make mistakes. It was the only space that I had where I walked into and was like, and was not like, I can't make mistakes. I could say, I could go on and on and on and on. But I was shown that I was enough. That I had it all. And his words are, be yourself. And those were his actual words to me. One day when he asked me if I was nervous about coming to do it, this was after I finished his courses, he asked me if I was nervous about coming in to speak to his students, and I was like, oh, heck yes. And he's like, be yourself. And yeah, and the other thing that I would say is one of the things that I was not used to, but I was like, oh my God, this feels good. He used the phrase learning alongside you a lot, and he still does. When he would tell me that I'm excited to learn alongside you, and when he pointed out that I had things to contribute, it was like, oh my God, this is not something I'm used to. And when he said learning alongside you, and reframed what teaching is for me. And when he says that I'm excited to learn alongside you, it's like, learn? What do I have to teach you? I don't know anything. You're the one that's teaching here. But then over the years, it's been like, it's, you have the knowledge. My role is to only show you that you do.
I sometimes wonder whether teachers appreciate the impact that they do have, that they can have on the students that come through their hands, both in terms of the negative experience and the positive experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm just so glad that you did experience a teacher who helped you to refine your passion and love of learning, to see different ways forward for yourself going forward.
Mm-hmm. And so, as I said, this is just like a nutshell of so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me what drew you into the work that you're doing now.
As I said, I experienced barriers, but so have a million other people who are both disabled and non-disabled. But I will stick to, I was lost and then I was found. And my organization that I have formed, not alone, I will repeat, really focuses on education. And that was my greatest struggle. So being lost and being found gave me the passion to want to help others find themselves through their struggles.
And tell us what kind of work your NGO does.
So my not-for-profit organization provides parent support groups for mothers particularly, and that's one of the things. And that stemmed from me being a child, being born to young parents, and me now as an adult thinking back on what my life was and what my parents' life looked like, in wanting it so badly for them, which then grew the desire in me to give it to other parents. I also provide, and I know I'm saying let's switch it to the organization provides career support and mentorship in finding a job as a disabled person, learning how to write resumes, learning how to tackle interviews, because I know what it feels like to be clueless on what on earth a resume looks like, or walking into interviews with a knot in my stomach. And we all know that disabled people have that for many reasons, not just the quote unquote normal nerds of, oh my gosh, am I going to get this job? Because there are many reasons that they wouldn't. And that's just the world that we live in that has just decided that. I also provide ESL, which is English as a second language. Yeah. Which is particularly designed for youth with disabilities. And that came from the desire of wanting to, as I was waiting to go to school, you'll recall from my book that I talk about going past buildings where ESL classes were delivered and asking my mom, can I go here? And she's like, nope. And I'm like, why? And she's like, because you're too young. But there was also another reason. And I experienced that reason when having the desire to learn my own language. Because I did know how to speak Arabic, but I didn't know how to read and write until I came to Canada. And I had an experience of where I walked into or my mom was going to take me into a class, but the teacher declined because she said she has a disability. And those were feelings I wish upon no one. And I am fully aware that there are disabled folks that come into, for instance, Canada, that are beyond the age of starting school, like at the age that I did, or going to high school and going to college or what have you, but they simply just don't have the language that is necessary to move about and succeed in this new place that they're going to call home.
I think it sounds like you're doing some really amazing work to assist the people in the world around you. I want to change topics. Well, it's not totally changing topics, but I want to just learn a little bit more from you about the memoir that we've both referenced it a couple of times already in this conversation. But tell us about what it was that drew you to writing a memoir.
So my story has been told time and time again, in many ways, by many people, including my mentor, who wrote about my experience in his dissertation, but that was the most accurate representation, I would say. And I say these words very loudly. But it was having the experience of being silenced. No one knew my side of the story. And as you may have noticed, or have, that I have a very unique way of telling my story. And I've told it in a way that no one has. And the advocate side of things, of me, had the desire to tell my story, to communicate to those with disabilities that you are not alone. And I'm going to reference the words that are in my acknowledgement and say that I wanted to show, I want to tell people and make it a clear message that you don't have to live your life according to somebody else's agenda. And don't settle for it.
So what you haven't given us is the title of the book and where people can get hold of it.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so the title of my book is what I call the death sentence. My book is not called The Death Sentence, but the death sentence that I lived through alongside my parents. And that was being told that you have 24 hours to live.
And where can people buy copies of it?
The most accessible place, I think, is Amazon. It is available as an ebook and as paperback. And it is also available on a website that supports independent bookstores called bookshop.org, where I have my own online bookshop there as well. It is also available just as of last week on Google Play.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
No problem.
If people would like to reach out to you to learn more about your work, to find out a little bit more about what you are doing and about your organization, how can they find you? Where can they contact you?
So our contact information is on our website. That is www.beyondabilities.ca. And my email that you can reach me at to get to the organization is beyondabilities51@gmail.com. beyondabilities51@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you. We will add those links as well as the links to your books in the show notes, so people will be able to find them there as well.
And I'm happy to send my email to you, Lois, so that you can include it in the show notes, because just for the sake of spelling what Beyond Abilities is spelled with.
That'd be great. So, I'd really appreciate that. Any links that you can send me that I can just copy across just makes my life that little bit easier. So that's great. Thank you.
No problem.
As a final question then, what advice would you give to a young person with a disability who is navigating the education system and experiencing some challenges?
It's kind of two layered. One, I would say, is there is light at the end of the tunnel. And there is someone there out there that does see you and your self-worth. Sometimes it just takes a little longer. So never stop searching. And also from personal experience is it is important for others to see your worth and who you are, but stand your ground and know who you are first. Because that will make you stronger through your fight to find that other additional person, like I have.
That's great. Thank you so much. Gofran Alias, thank you so much for joining us on A Different Way of Seeing. It has been really great to have the time to just chat to you and to learn a little bit more about your story.
Thank you for, I'm so grateful for the opportunity and for the safe space that was created for me to talk about the things that I talked about today.
Thank you for listening to A Different Way of Seeing. We'd love to connect with you. So find Lois at loisstrachan.com or Facebook, Lois Strachan Speaker. This podcast was edited by Craig Strachan using Hindenburg Pro. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. The credits are done at Naledi Media. Naledi Media, all your vocal needs under one roof. Read by Charlie Yazi. That's it for now. Thank you for joining us and see you next time when we bring you into the world of seeing differently.